Welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Nathan Fraser about how to work with the law system in the best way possible and what approach to have in a reasonable way within the system, of course, when accusations come. And as Nathan has been explaining now, also how to get out of certain situations where, of course, there is no harmed party, if you will, or the damage of property, I guess. I'm going to ask more about that later. But you were on a really interesting track there. We were basically talking about this case of someone who hasn't been driving, you know, with a license, the plates were wrong or something like that. And with the process of discovery, as you're explaining, you were asking for certain things and managed to basically get the whole case kicked out. Tell us more about that and what kind of things you asked for this to happen.
Yeah. First of all, I would like to clarify, I wouldn't really take this as a how-to. It's just more of a me explaining how I see things and the experiences that I've had implementing the way that I see things. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Well, I understand that, because what I've noticed as well, as we talk with you, Nathan, and other people who are, you know, involved in the same thing as well, it seems to be, and I kind of alluded to this earlier, but it still seems to be very much to kind of who you're dealing with. And it's a matter of interpretation. It's a matter of what words are used. It could even be in some cases how you use the words, right? As a, you know, and what kind of connection you make with the people that you're in contact with, etc. There's a number of different variables that you need to be, you know, pretty much aware of for something like this to work. It seems like there's no kind of one size fits all, if you know what I mean, Nathan.
Yeah, well, I found this, the approach that I take, I found it to be highly consistent. The only inconsistency that I found is one particular judge here in Fort Collins at the municipal court. Her name's Kathleen Lane, and I don't have any problems saying her name on the radio. But I've gone in front of her twice on my own cases, and I've had three friends go in front of her. And one of the things that's the very last failsafe that we try to do, or actually I've successfully done every single time that I've ever been involved with any kind of cases, impeaching the witnesses. And I've impeached every single witness, or I've had her impeach, I guess I should clarify. Mm-hmm. She's impeached every single witness that's ever came against me. She's impeached every single piece of evidence that's ever came against me, and she still finds me guilty. And it's because she has a huge grudge against me. And she's the municipal court judge, which means in order to appeal her decision, she's like the lowest court judge, which means she can't really, she can fine people and that's about it.
Right.
So she'll fine me $100. She'll drop my fine down to $100. But in order to appeal it, I have to pay the transcript fee, and I have to pay the appellant fee. And that means I'm going to have to pay $250 to get my $100 back.
Right.
So with the exception of that one judge, consistently the approach that I take and the approach that other people have taken has worked over and over and over again. So like I said, 75% of the time, and that 25% being in this particular courtroom, and it's against this particular judge. And she's flat out said, I've called her on it. I said, you just broke rule of evidence number 601. You just broke rule of evidence 604. And she says, if you don't like it, you can appeal. And she knows that the appeal is going to cost more than what the fine is going to be. So if you, like I said, at the very beginning of this, you're dealing with criminals and they've got the guns. And just because they set up the rules to where this will work, they're not above breaking their own rules if they want to prove a point. Wow. Or make an example out of you.
Wow. So there is no oversight here and no one else that you can go to for this blatant violation, if you will.
Yeah. Again, I could go to government to fix the problem of government. I could go to another judge and be like, hey, judge, take my side against this other judge.
And that would happen.
Yeah, on an appeal, it would probably get, but it's not worth $250 for me to appeal a $100 fine.
Right, right.
But as far as like a judicial review or something like that, I just don't really remain hopeful. But in the future, if I ever have to deal with it again, I have educated myself on which process to take in the future. So if it does come up to it again, maybe I'll have a different opinion about it in the future.
Hmm. All right. Well, very interesting. So go ahead and tell us a bit more before I cut you off earlier there in terms of what what procedure you use, basically, and what method you use to get the, you know, witnesses impeached and all that, etc.
Yeah, well, with this most recent case that I was telling you about, the guy got a hold of me on Thursday. He had court on Friday. He kind of had an idea. He'd read the book that I make available, and he was working with Mark Stevens, and he called me up because he's in Colorado. I'm in Colorado, quote unquote, the fictional state of Colorado. He called me up and he asked if I had anything specifically made out for Colorado, and I said, well, yeah, I put in this. Usually the very first thing before I enter a plea is I want to be fully informed and knowledgeable about what's going on. So I put these two in. I put a request for discovery and I put in a motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute and failure to provide adequate discovery. And I emailed them to him and I said, if you feel like you want to use them or if you feel like you want to use them for a template for your own stuff, feel free. I'm not a very big intellectual property guy, so I said, go ahead and whatever work I've done, if you want to improve on it or just straight up copy it, you know, it's your whatever you want to do. And he had court the next day. I didn't hear from him until Monday, so I was kind of worried that he went to jail, which is a possibility. Like I said, you're dealing with people that if they get angry, they can absolutely hold you in contempt or, you know, point the guns at you and stick you in a cage. So I was kind of worried that happened, but he got a hold of me on Monday and told me that he went in, put both of the pieces of paperwork in, went to the judge. The judge asked him what he was wanting to plea. He said that he didn't feel fully informed. He didn't feel like he was completely aware of what was going on and he needed to know the answers to the questions that he put forth in the discovery, and he couldn't enter a plea until he had the answers for the discovery. And the judge looked over his discovery request and looked over his motion to dismiss, and the judge told him, I'm going to go ahead and dismiss this, but not because I find any merit to the paperwork that you've put in. He said that the paperwork had nothing to do with his decision, but he was going to go ahead and dismiss it anyways. And when this particular individual asked, well, why are you dismissing it? The judge just told him he's not going to give him an answer, that if he wanted to know the answer, he'd have to go get a lawyer. But he was very intent on reinforcing it had nothing to do with the paperwork. It was only because that was his decision.
So it's something to do with the paperwork then. Yep.
Yeah. Black is white, I guess, up is down. But also I also wanted to address one common misconception too. And that's the idea that getting driver's license or getting social security cards or getting, registering your car gives them control over your vehicle. Every single case that I've ever talked to anybody about, every single person that's ever taken the stuff that I do and tried to mimic it, every single time, all of them had driver's license or expired driver's license. All of them have had social security cards. All of them have been in registered vehicle. Well, except for one. Majority of them have been in registered vehicles. Majority of them have jobs, bank accounts, credit cards with the all capital letters name, and none of that has ever mattered.
Right.
It's never, I always hear these, well, the reason that they were able to apply their law to you is because you have this document or you have this piece of paper. And every single time that we've had a case thrown out because they couldn't prove the law applied, those people still had those documents. So I don't think there's very much credibility to those claims because my particular experiences have gone completely contrary to that concept.
Right. Yeah. We've heard things like, you know, you have to basically write yourself out of the system or not be part of it in any regard or not have any connection to it or your name appear anywhere, etc. That's what we've heard, right? But in your experience, then that doesn't matter.
In my experience, that has no weight whatsoever.
Yeah. So. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, well, that does make sense as well then, if the law indeed does make sense. But it should be on a you know, basis to basis kind of situation. It shouldn't be. I mean, would they even have the? I mean, I don't know how much background check they do or if they find you in any registers or records or things like that. But in your experience, is the system all that together? Is it that advanced, if you know what I mean? Or I mean, it, as a case shows up to them, they just try to, you know, deal with it as quickly as possible, and that's that, right? I guess it depends on how high profile the case is.
I think it's getting more, the communication is getting better between the different branches and different agencies and departments. But like I said, the very first case that we got thrown out, it was my buddy Jeremiah, who often comes on the show, Live Free FM. He comes on there with me a lot. The very first case that we got thrown out was his case, and it was for speeding. And he had a driver's license, and he had insurance on the vehicle, and the car was registered in his girlfriend's name, and none of that mattered. The judge, after he asked three simple questions to the officer on his cross-examination, the judge looked at the judge cut off his line of questioning, told him he couldn't ask any more questions. Looked at the prosecutor, looked at the cop, and then looked back at us and rambled for a second, and then turned around and said, having said all of that, the prosecutor has failed to prove that the laws of the road apply to you, so I'm going to go ahead and dismiss this. So he had his driver's license right there on file. He had the insurance right there on file, and he still stated right there in open court, this does not prove that the rules of the road apply, and it's not sufficient to prove that, and I'm going to have to throw out the case.
So what were those three questions then?
Can we hold off on that until later on?
Okay, I'll bring that up later then, okay?
Yeah, I will, though, since we're kind of talking about the arraignment process right now, I will kind of get into what I do when they're trying to get a guilty or not guilty plea out of me, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
So what my approach is, and I don't take credit for coming up with this approach. Like I said, I learned this from Mark Stevens, and I think actually he would probably be a good guest if you guys ever tried.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've heard about him before, and we definitely should invite him if you would like to come on. If you're in contact with him, let him know that we want to have him on, Nathan.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he'd be a great guest. But he taught me all of this stuff, and I just kind of took the ball and ran with it. When I go into an arraignment hearing, like I said, your plea has to be knowing and voluntary. They're not allowed to take a plea from somebody who has no idea what's going on, and they know that. So the very first question that I ask is, am I allowed to enter a plea if it's not knowing and voluntary? Are you allowed to accept a plea if it's not knowing and voluntary? And they'll say, yeah, absolutely. You have to make it knowing and voluntarily. And from that point, then I say, so if I don't understand something that's going on, I have the right to ask questions, and you're going to answer those questions and give me a substantial or informative answer to help me make a knowing and voluntary plea. And they'll always say yes. So then I'll usually, I can take a bunch of different approaches from that point, but usually what I do is I start off with that, and then I start my questioning very vaguely. And they'll be very comfortable answering the questions, and I'll box them into a corner. And that's what I also do with the police officers or anybody that I'm cross-examining as well. And I'll box them into a corner where once they get to that point, they realize that if they answer the final question, they're going to blow the whole charade, and the veil of legitimacy is going to be completely thrown out. So a really good one is to ask, well, can I get a fair trial if there's a conflict of interest? And they'll say, well, no, obviously you couldn't get a fair trial if there's a conflict of interest. And then I ask, well, if you represented a party to these proceedings, would that be a conflict of interest? And they'll always say, well, yeah, absolutely, that would be a conflict of interest. I can't represent a party to the hearing. That would be, you know, that'd be like if you and your cousin got in a fight over $20 and you went to your uncle and asked him, you know, the cousin's father, and asked him who should get the $20, of course there's going to be conflict of interest and you're going to lose.
Right.
So they're going to say, no, you can't get a fair trial if there's a conflict of interest. And yes, it would be a conflict of interest if I represented one of the parties, and or if I had a relationship, a special relationship with one of the parties. And then at that point, I would just ask, well, who's the alleging party, or who's the party coming against me? Who does the prosecutor represent in this proceeding? And they'll say, well, the city or the state or the county, whatever it is. And then I ask, and who do you represent in these proceedings? And that's usually the knockout question.
Right.
They don't want to answer that, because if they answer it, the answer is they represent the city or the state or the county as well, which means they represent the same party that's coming against me. It'd be like your cousin and your uncle both teaming up against you. So
it's got to be funny, by the way, when you see that happen in the eyes, you know, of that person. It's like, oh.
Yeah. It's and that's the thing about it. I'll kind of get into this later as well. But the thing about it is once you go through this process, the entire veil of legitimacy of government starts crumbling and you start realizing these are just people and their titles and their costumes are just part of the brainwashing and none of it is legitimate. It's like you start realizing, oh, Horus, the sun god, isn't even real. And or Ra, the, you know, whatever deity it is, you start saying, oh, the state of Colorado isn't even real. And these priests that have been subjugating me to their rule my entire life actually have no authority over me. And that's a really eye-opening experience.
Very powerful, yeah, in that way. Or just kind of empowering rather than powerful. But, you know, that you realize as well that you've kind of worked yourself out of that situation. So, yeah, good. That's great.
Yeah. Wow. So, also, from there, I guess it's kind of important to know the rules of evidence as well. And the rules of evidence, we kind of got into them earlier with discovery, but the rules of evidence kind of outlay what the prosecutor is allowed to bring against you and what the judge is allowed to excuse as admissible against you. And this is something also, just like the rules of procedure, the rules of evidence are something that completely get ignored by 99% of the gurus out there teaching their particular method to find redemption in the court system. None of them ever cover the rules of evidence and none of them cover the rules of procedure. And I think that from my experience, those are the two most important things to understand. So the rules of evidence in the United States, we have something called the federal rules of evidence, and most of the states have adopted the federal rules of evidence. And it's just basically outlaying or telling you what can be used as admissible evidence. And most of the states have pretty much just done a direct, they just did a copy and paste, basically. So I'll be reading from the Colorado rules of evidence, but they're pretty much almost identical to the federal rules of evidence that I use against them. And rule 601 is the general rule of competency. And it's basically saying that unless otherwise determined, every person is competent to be a witness. And what that means is anybody can be a witness against you unless one of the other rules is violated. Like if they're declared to be not competent, then they can't be a witness. If they're declared to be not credible, then they can't be a witness. Mm-hmm. If the judge says that they're not allowed to testify to a certain particular matter, then that means that they're not, their testimony on that particular matter is no longer admissible. Rule 602 is lack of personal knowledge. It just basically says a witness may not testify to a matter unless evidence is introduced sufficient to support the finding that he has personal knowledge of the matter. So basically no hearsay. Rule 605, competency of a judge as the witness. And this is something that I run into all the time is judges trying to bail out the witness or trying to add their own two cents into the testimony. And that's absolutely forbidden. Mm-hmm. It says a judge presiding at the trial may not testify in the trial as a witness. No objection need be made to preserve this point. What that last sentence, no objection need be made to preserve this point. A lot of things, if you want to preserve your case for an appeal, you need to make objections. And you need, when the judge does something wrong or when the prosecutor does something wrong on the record, you need to object. You need to say object to that. And if they continue to do it anyways, at least you've got that preserved for appeal. When a judge starts testifying or starts offering testimony, you don't have to even object to that. If you bring that up in your appeal, all the appellate court has to look at is the record. And if sure enough the judge started testifying against you, which they do a lot, automatically their their decision is reversible. So, and then the last one, rule 1101, is applicability of the rules. The rules of evidence apply to all of the rule or all of the courts in the state of Colorado. And that's the same with the federal rules. The rules are applicable to all of the courts. So, there's a lot of other rules, but those are the ones that I specifically go after when I'm doing my cross-examination or when I'm pretty much doing anything as far as dealing with these black-robed bandits.
So tell us how you approach that then, if you're able to recognize that a judge themselves are part of the process more than they should be. Do you just basically call them on that when that happens, or how do you, I mean, again, because ultimately if the judge is the one who's deciding everything and if they're in a position of where they practically are above the law or can do whatever they please, then what happens there? How do you bring that to their attention?
Really, all you can do is object to it. That's really your only, that's your only recourse is to object. And I'll object to everything. I know the rules well enough. And like I said, I've been studying this stuff, at least this particular aspect of it, for about 4 years now. So when I'm watching a case go or when I'm in my own case, as soon as they violate something, I'm objecting to it. Really, the objection only, sometimes the objection will stop them from doing it. Sometimes they'll just keep continuing doing it, like Miss Kathleen Lane that I mentioned earlier. I object to her and she just says, well, if you don't like it, you can appeal, and then continues doing it. So sometimes it'll stop them. I've objected to things that judges have done and they realize that I wasn't going to just stand there and take it, and they've stopped, and sometimes they won't. So object to it. I don't really object to it over and over. I object to it the one time. I preserve it for my appeal if it has to go that far. And then I continue forward.
Wow. Okay. Well, there we go. You talked a little bit about cross-examining the witness and challenge basically evidence as well that's made against you or the person representing. Is there anything more to add to that?
Oh yes, there's a lot to add to that. So, I kind of mentioned earlier that if a judge rules that a witness can't testify to a certain aspect, then that means that everything that is in their testimony regarding that aspect has to be stricken from the record. And what that is called is impeachment. And so what an impeachment is when a judge says this particular witness is not credible, qualified, or competent to testify to this particular aspect. And that's what, if I can't get it thrown out with motions to dismiss, if I can't get it thrown out based off of the inability to provide me adequate discovery, if I can't get it thrown out and it goes all the way to an actual trial, then my last kind of Hail Mary, which has actually been the most consistent thing that myself and others have gotten our cases thrown out on, is getting the judge to impeach the witness against you. Because like I said at the very beginning, the judge's opinions and the legal opinions of the judge and the legal opinions of the prosecutor do not count as evidence. Yeah. So they can have all their opinions that they want. If they don't have evidence, if they don't have facts, and if they don't have witnesses that are credible, competent, and qualified to testify to the allegations, then they have absolutely nothing at all. And I've already established that they have no facts and no evidence to prove, you know, jurisdiction or corpus delicti, applicability of the law, or my presence within their legal fiction. The last thing that they're going to rely on is the testimony of the cop. And I guess if we can, I'll just kind of go through how usually examination works and then how I approach my cross-examination.
Sure. Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So usually if you go to your hearing and you sit there in the court and they'll do this whole thing about trying to make the officer look like he's really qualified to make the determinations that he made, he's going to – this is probably 99-100% of the time what I see. They get him up. They ask the officer how long he's been a cop for, when he was certified on whatever equipment that he used, what he saw on the day in question, how the stop went, how your attitude was, and a bunch of different other questions that kind of, in my opinion, they're just it's procedure. They just ask the same things over and over and over again. Every single time that I've been, it's the same like standard line of questioning to make the cop look like he's a credible witness and to make it look like he knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
And then they give you the opportunity to cross-examine. And I mentioned earlier, I never offer any testimony because if I offer testimony, that makes me subject to cross-examination where they can start asking me all kind of questions and I don't want to put myself in that position. And if you're somebody who's trying this for the first or the second time, I would not recommend putting yourself in that situation either. Because it's a very intimidating situation to be in. And it's if they can get you emotionally attached or if they can shake you emotionally, they can get you off your square.
That's
not where you want to be.
That's right. Yeah. So this is a strategy. It's like any game, really. That's what it is.
It is. And it's really a battle of wits. And if you know the rules, and I'm not talking about the rules that are some esoteric rules that I can't find any kind of basis for, like all capital letter name or a maritime jurisdiction or some sort of invisible ship that I'm walking into by crossing the bar.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about those rules because I can't find any proof of those rules, but I can find proof of the rules of evidence and the rules of procedure. And if you're going to come to play a game of chess, it benefits you to know the rules of the chessboard. And so it's a high stakes game, but it is a battle of wits. Absolutely.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, I've heard other people talk about this too, but they, I mean, the interest from the party, from the state is to, to squeeze money out of you, to squeeze revenue out of you or in some other capacity or manner, put you behind bars because it's beneficial to the state in different ways, ultimately there as well, the prison economy, etc. So that's kind of that's what people have to realize as well, that these people are really not there to help you in any way. And it's just what you explained at the beginning as well, that you have all these different parties involved in the process, but ultimately they represent the same side, you know, and it's going to be against you. So the odds are very tough in that way. So it might be very difficult to kind of stay strong, if you will, in that situation. But the more you learn about the system, the more you understand, the more you empower yourself with what you can do with it, the more confident you get. And therefore, it becomes easier, right? Does it become easier for you, Nathan?
Yeah, and well, for me, I've never really had the concept of authority. It's probably been, maybe there's something wrong with my brain. I don't know. Maybe it was just the way I was raised, but I've never really bought into the concept of authority. Even in school, I was constantly in trouble because I didn't recognize the authority of teachers. So, I mean, I fear the fact that there's a bunch of men with guns there.
Yep.
I understand they can take my life, but as far as going against somebody and being intimidated by them because they're wearing a black robe and they're sitting 3 feet higher than everybody else in the room.
Mm.
It never really had that effect on me, but I can say that when anybody that I've ever gone to court with, when they get their cases dismissed, all of a sudden that fear and that intimidation is almost lifted immediately. And that's really the main reason why I do this is to kind of one by one open people's eyes to the fact that we don't need to be living in fear of these people. They do have the guns and they do have the veil of legitimacy, but if we can get rid of the veil of legitimacy and just leave them with their guns, they're really not nearly as powerful as they were with the veil of legitimacy.
Yeah, it becomes a whole lot more clear about what this is about because, again, a lot of this has been about the perception of giving people the perception that things are okay, that the system is okay, that it's there to help you and to represent you. And in that case, it's just as democracy. It's a false veneer, if you will, of what they're trying to convey. And ultimately, the more this can be exposed for what it truly is and what it truly represents, the better off it will be for the majority of people that understand that, all right, wait a minute, you know, the concept here is more clear now. I understand that they are not there to help me. They're effectively, you know, kind of my enemy, if you will. And therefore, you know, I think that they, when people get a different approach to it overall of what it actually is, it becomes a whole lot more easier because then you kind of, it's what we talked about earlier, kind of knowing who your enemy are, right, Nathan?
Yeah. And I would say to even clarify that, I would classify these people as part of a predatory class. I think that They're human beings just like us, but they're human beings that prey on their fellow human beings, just like the average mugger on the street does, just like the average rapist does. These people prey on their fellow human beings, but because they wear these costumes and they do these little ceremonies and they have these chants and we all pledge allegiance to them, their predatory actions are viewed as legitimate. And once that no longer is in the minds of the masses, once the people no longer view their predatory actions as legitimate, then those people will be viewed the same as the common thief and the common rapist. And really, then society will treat them like we treat the common thug. And that's really what my goal is to get people to that point where we've lifted that perception of legitimacy and we see these people as the predators that they are.
Yeah, I would call them parasites. They don't actually do anything. They live off of other people. And no matter who wins at the end of the trial, they are the ones who get well paid, if you know what I mean. And there's no tangible process in their work. They're actually just kind of representatives of the service economy, if you will. They're just pushing papers back and forth, and in the process, you know, they charge you money for doing that, but they actually don't do anything. And really, I mean, how much do they really resolve when it comes to damage to property or you know, some of these other things? I mean, usually it just ends up costing a whole lot more money, the process that they're involved in, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I'm glad you brought up that point, because that brings something up that I probably should have brought up at the very beginning. And that's just the decision of whether or not you're going to fight your own case. You have to understand that as soon as you've been cited, you've pretty much lost. You're driving from your house to work and you get pulled over. At that point, you've already started a losing battle. That you've already lost your time. You've already had to go through the emotional stress of having a man with a gun come up to your window and start demanding stuff of you. Mm. You've already started losing. So it's really a game or a decision of how much you're going to lose, how much you're willing to risk. It's basically a damage control type of thing. So for me, more often than not, I'm willing to take it all the way. For other people, I say, if you do want to take this on, realize that even if you go all the way through and get your case dismissed, which is pretty likely going to happen, you're still probably going to have to sit through however many hours of court. You're still going to have to study. You're still going to have to fill out some motions. You're still going to have to waste time driving down to the court and putting your motions in. You're still going to have to they're going to take however many hours of your life away whole time, especially if it's your first time and you're very stressed out by it. How much stress is this going to cause? How many nights are you going to lose sleep over this? As soon as they've aggressed against you till the actual whole thing is resolved, the entire time you're losing every single second of the way. So really, you have to make that decision for yourself. How much is it worth to me? How, you know, if it's a $20, if I can get them to plea this down to a $20 plea bargain, and the other option is go to court and spend 6 hours in court and lose 6 hours worth of work, which one is the more viable option for me? And so I always tell people, you're in a losing battle from the get. You might get your case dismissed, but that's really not even a victory, because you lost all that time. You lost all that stress. You lost all that sleep. So you have to decide for yourself what your terms of an agreement would be, and go in there, see if you can get that. If sometimes with some people it's dismissed, no matter what, I want this dismissed. And so they might get it dismissed right away. They might have to take it all the way to trial to get it dismissed. They might have to take it to appeal. Some people say, well, if I can get it plead down, if I can plead this down to a $20 fine or a $50 fine, that'd be good enough for me. So it's really a damage control. What damage are you willing to accept? Because you've already been damaged from the second that you've been pulled over. How much damage are you willing to accept before you just take it all the way?
So in some cases, you've decided it's better to just kind of let it go, if you will, or kind of, you know, agree to their terms and just kind of move on with your life and focus on something else instead? Have you come to that situation ever?
Only twice, and it's been with that same judge that I mentioned earlier.
Right.
Two times I went before her and I fought it all the way, and she broke every single rule. And I knew that if I was going to appeal it, it was going to cost me more than the fine even was. So I didn't appeal either of those two decisions. And the next two times that I got, actually the second time that I went before her, when we were in court, they had probably 7 or 8 police officers in there trying to intimidate me. I went out after court. I went out to my car. I had 2 tickets on my car. And then as I was driving away, I got followed out of the courtroom or out of the court parking lot by 4 police officers who waited about 4 blocks, pulled me over, cited me for the same 2 things over again. And with those 2 that I got in the parking lot, it was back in that courtroom again. So on those ones, when I went into them, I just talked to the prosecutor. I was like, we both know she's not going to follow any of the rules. We both know that she's not going to find in my favor, no matter she'll impeach the witnesses and she'll still find against me. So what are you willing to do? And in both of those 2 situations, he said, look, I understand where you're coming from. I understand that she's ruling in my favor illegitimately. I'm willing to just drop this. And one of them was a $300 ticket and one of them was a $200 ticket. He says, if you don't want to fight these and go through the whole rigmarole, I'll go ahead and just drop these to a $20 citation. So I got both of those dropped to a single payment of $20. And I ended up walking out. That was because I didn't want to go through the whole thing again. I didn't want to lose the $500. And I was pretty certain that I was going to. So that's even myself. Most of the time I'll fight it all the way through. Most of the time I'm successful, but if I know it's going to be a losing battle, I decide for myself, how much am I willing to lose? If losing $20 gets it to the point where I'm not going to have to go through this whole process again, at least in her courtroom, I just paid the $20. And that's kind of a cop-out move, but it was damage control.
Well, yeah. Well, I understand why. I mean, bothering you like that and just making it difficult for you. So, yeah, she at least then has an eye on you and gotten that. And do you have anything to say in terms of who ends up being the judge for a case? Is there anything you can influence in that regard?
You can have the judge recuse themselves. And in this judge particularly, she won't recuse herself. I've tried to get her to recuse herself. And I've actually had to have cases removed from her courtroom. So that's one way to do it. But typically you can have the judge, you can request the judge recuse themselves. But the other 2, like I said, I got cited 4 times that day, twice in the parking lot and twice about 4 blocks away. The other 2 citations were in the county court building. And I walked into there and I used the same approach that I always use. And before they even went to arraignment, the prosecutor on that one, which was under a different judge, she took it to the judge. She brought my discovery request to the judge and she called me back the next day and said, yeah, we're going to go ahead and dismiss these. So The same 2 citations, the same evidence in both cases for all 4 citations. And the 2 that were in front of one judge, she just wouldn't let go of. And the 2 that were in front of the county court judge, he just said, I'm not even going to bother with this. I'm going to go ahead and throw it out. So yes, it does come down to the personal judge that you're going against and how much of an example they want to make out of you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Again, it's back to, you'd think that a system like this, that's based on so much, you know, paperwork and everything else, that it would be more robotic, I guess, and objective. But again, it just shows that it's really who you're dealing with and who you know, and that at the end of the day, you know, connections and nepotism and everything else, that's really what rules our world, right?
And these are people. I mean, you've got human flaws. Some people, some people, when you insult their paradigm, they're going to come at you with everything they have. And when you go in there saying, hey, I want to know what you rely on to prove these things that nobody ever asks for you to prove, and you've never even asked yourself, what kind of proof do I have that I have the right to rule over these people and tell them how to live their lives. Most of these judges have never even thought about this. Yeah. Most of these prosecutors have never even thought about what they're actually doing. This is what they went to school for. This is what they do. This is what all their friends do that are judges. And they never actually question it. And when you attack their paradigm by saying, hey, the very foundation of what you believe, the very foundation of these charges against me, I'm challenging that. And nobody has ever challenged that before. Some people will say, okay, this is kind of crazy and I don't want to deal with it. I'm going to go ahead and dismiss this. Some people will say, you know what? You got me. I'm going to have to go ahead and throw this case out. And then some people will say, what? You can't tell me. Blah, 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 and they'll attack you. And this doesn't just go with court. I mean, if you try and tell somebody who's a diehard statist that taxation is theft, they might give you a reasonable response, or they might feel attacked and attack you back. If you try to tell somebody, hey, Building 7 shouldn't have fallen the way that it did on 9/11, they might give you a reasonable response, or they might feel attacked in their paradigm and they might come after you with everything that they have. So you're dealing with people that, yes, they're in costumes, and yes, we believe that they're gods amongst men, but the reality of the situation is they're people.
Yeah, well, that's hilarious. A really good point. You upset their whole worldview, and of course, in some cases, maybe it's not as conscious as this, but at least an unconscious process. I think it's some people, they have the perception that, you know, it's due to them and their existence and the state and everything else that they make the whole world go around, and without them, things would just, you know, shatter in complete chaos. You know, so when you come along and challenge those very fundamental ideas. Yeah, I can see why they wouldn't want to kind of go after you. Crazy.
Yeah, it's I've only encountered it one time, but I have faced the full wrath of it once I encountered it. So
interesting, very interesting. Well, at the end of the day, this is also a deeper philosophical point of our existence, and I think that we when we can share that with other people of waking them up and making them become aware, or at least question, or at least think about what they are a part of and what they're doing, then that's a good thing. No matter if, I think it probably what usually happens is the more violently they react to it, it probably means that it actually has a, you know, more profound and a deeper that's what they feel about it much more deeply, and they really feel initially offended by it, but it means that it's kind of struck home, if you know what I mean, Nathan.
Yeah, the response is an adequate measurement of the effect that it had on them.
There we go. Said it much better than I did.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So what is the some other things here that we might have left out of the process now, Nathan, so we're not missing anything here?
Well, let's jump into cross-examination. So we kind of explained what happens on examination. What cross-examination is your chance to challenge everything that the prosecutor is using against you. So if he's got evidence, you have the right to challenge the evidence. If he's got witnesses, which 9 times out of 10, the only thing he has is witnesses, especially if there's no victim, if there's no property damage or anything like that, it's just going to be the word of the officer, and that's going to be the only witness against you. And so in cross-examination, you're allowed to examine, or anything that has come up as previous testimony, it's open for your cross-examination. So if the prosecutor asks a question and the officer is allowed to answer that question to build up his case, then you're allowed to attack or challenge that question, or you're allowed to question on the answer to that question. If you ask a question and he's allowed to answer it, you're allowed to get more specific and kind of narrow it down to as to what he's saying. And that's usually the approach that I take. The first thing that you have to understand is the entire case rests upon the legal opinions of the police officer, because like I said a couple times throughout this interview, the legal opinions of the officer are the only ones that matter. The legal opinions of the judge are not valid testimony or evidence. The legal opinions of the prosecutor are not valid testimony or evidence. The only legal opinions that are allowed are the ones from the cop. And everything that he wrote on the citation for when he pulled you over, for when he stopped you and found marijuana in your pocket, or whatever the situation may be, every single thing that this entire case rests upon are completely based off of his legal opinions. He's the one that made the opinion that you were in the state of Colorado. He's the one that made the opinion that you broke the law. He's the one that made the opinion that the law applied to you in the first place. Every single thing that their entire case rests upon is his legal opinions. Every single thing on the ticket is his legal opinions or her legal opinions. Impeachment is when a judge says that this particular witness is not capable of rendering this type of testimony. So since I know that the entire case rests upon the legal opinions of the officer, and without the legal opinions of the officer, the ticket is not valid, and without the legal opinions of the officer, the entire case has to be dismissed, what I'm going to do is I'm going to attack the ability for the officer to make legal opinions. And I'm going to do it the very same way that I attack the judge when he's trying to come after me and make me enter a plea. And that's by asking very vague questions that they will allow to be answered, and then narrowing down my questions to a point where the police officer either has to answer and throw out the whole legitimacy, the whole veil of legitimacy, or what happens every single time I've been to court, every single time I've cross-examined a witness, and every single time that somebody else who's used the same process that I use has done it, every single time the prosecutor has jumped up or the judge has jumped up and declared the witness incapable of rendering legal determinations. And at that point, before I say what I do at that point, would you kind of like an explanation of how I get to that point?
Yeah, let's do that. I think that's good.
Okay, so I'll give a couple of different examples. One way is to my buddy Jeremiah, the one that he got thrown out and this is like one of the most memorable ones to me because it was the first time that I actually saw a judge admit that the rules don't apply to anybody. And what he did is he got the cop on the stand and he said, "Officer, is it your testimony that on the date in question, I was within the state of Colorado?" And the cop said, "Well, yeah, you were in the state of Colorado." And Jeremiah says, "Is that a factual based opinion or is that an arbitrary opinion?" And the cop says, "No, it's a fact. You were in Colorado." And he says, "Okay, if I wasn't in Colorado on that date, would this court have jurisdiction over me?" And the cop said, "Well, no, but you were in Colorado and it's a fact that you were in Colorado." So Jeremiah looked at the cop and he said, "All right, factually speaking, what is the state of Colorado?" And like we mentioned earlier, the state of Colorado is a legal fiction. Mm. And legally, it doesn't even actually exist because there's no duty to protect. So factually, the state doesn't exist. Legally, the state doesn't exist. And he just asked this cop who previously testified he was within the state, he asked the cop to clarify what he means when he says he was in the state. And the cop just stood there, or sat there, I guess, in the cross-examination booth. He just sat there and he looked like a deer caught in the headlights. He had no idea how to answer the question.
Yeah.
And he's looking like he's drowning. He's looking to the judge to help him. He's looking for the prosecutor to throw him a lifeguard or a lifesaver.
Yeah.
And neither one of them knew what to do. And so after about 30 or 40 seconds of complete silence, he goes, "I'll ask the question again. Factually, what is a state?" And the judge cuts him off and he says, "You're not allowed to continue this line of questioning. And unless you have any further questions that aren't along this line of questioning, I'm going to go ahead and stop your cross-examination." And Jeremiah says, "Well, that's really the only question that I had, but he testified that I was in the state, so I would like for him to clarify what the state is."
Yeah.
And the judge looks at him and he goes, "That's enough." And so Jeremiah sat down, and like I mentioned earlier, he rambled for about 2 or 3 minutes and then looked at us and said, "Due to the fact that the prosecutor has failed to prove that you are obligated to follow the rules of the road in Colorado, I'm going to go ahead and dismiss this case." So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, so it's down to the exactly if you And if you can do this, which you guys managed to do without getting to the point of just simply annoying the judge, if you will, because of all the questions, but it seems like if you can hit the most important points in terms of defining within the terms that they are, you know, that they're asking you to provide evidence or to deny evidence, what have you. But if you manage to find that point, then they cannot explain it. They cannot define it, and therefore it, you know, they realize that it's falling apart, the whole thing.
Yeah, the whole foundation of their allegation against you just falls right. It's like a house of cards, and you pulled out the very bottom card, and the whole thing just comes crumbling down.
Yeah.
If I could, I'd give another example as well.
Sure. Yeah.
So another mutual friend of mine and Jeremiah's, Chris, he got a case up in Denver, Colorado for speeding. And he went through the initial arraignment process, and they refused to answer any of his questions. The judge entered a plea on his behalf, and he was really intimidated. He was scared to death of what was going to happen when he went back to court. Well, when he went back to court the second time, it was another judge. The first judge had recused himself, and then a female judge had taken over the case. And I guess she was a more qualified judge, and she had Chris's number, so she was gonna make an example out of him to the entire court. And it was real funny because she called him. The very first person that got called up was him. She called him in, and she asked him if he was ready to proceed, and he said he didn't really feel comfortable proceeding, but he didn't think he had a choice, so he was going to go ahead and proceed. And so she asks him, she says, the prosecutor does his examination, and then she allows Chris to do his cross-examination. And the first question that Chris does, he asks the officer, he goes, "Officer, did you file a valid cause of action against me?" And the cop looked at him and said, "I don't understand. I don't know what a cause of action is." And so he asked the judge to explain what the cause of action was. And the judge explained that the cause of action is what caused the court to take action. In this particular case, it was the ticket. So he restated the question. He says, "Did you file a valid ticket against me?" And the officer said, "Yeah, it was a valid ticket." And he goes, "Officer, how many elements are in a valid ticket?" And the officer had no idea. And the judge jumped up in his defense and she says, "This officer is not capable of rendering legal conclusions. I'm going to strike. I'm going to strike that question. And any legal conclusions that the officer has are not going to be acceptable as testimony from this officer." And so Chris said, "Okay, that's fine. I'd like to move to strike all of the officer's legal determinations from the record then." And the judge kind of looked at him and she goes, "That's fine. Would you like to proceed in your questioning?" And he goes, "Well, if you're going to strike all the legal determinations, I'd also appreciate it if you strike all of the legal determinations that were included on the original ticket. I'd like the ticket stricken from the record as well." Mm. And the judge looked at him and kind of sat there for a second, and she looked down at her paperwork, and she looked at the cop, and she asked the cop, "Officer, do you have your notes from this particular stop?" And the cop said, no, Your Honor, I don't." And she looked back at Chris, and she goes, "Okay, I'm going to go ahead and strike the ticket, and I'm going to dismiss this case." Mm. And so the reason, I'll kind of explain why, is because she just, on the record, she made a ruling that this witness is not allowed to render legal testimony.
Right. I can't believe she said that, but there we go.
But they do it all the time. And that's usually, like I said, every single time I ask questions that require them to make a legal determination.
Yeah.
But the questions that I ask, I know that they're not going to be able to answer. Like, "What's your proof that I was within the state? What's your proof that the Constitution applies to me?" That's another one that I use. Does this court get its jurisdiction from the Constitution? What evidence do you have to prove that the Constitution is applicable to me? Mm. Are you saying I violated a statute? They'll say yes. What evidence do you have that the statute applies to me? Objection, calls for a legal determination. My clients or my witness isn't capable of rendering legal determinations. Factually, what is a statute? Objection, calls for a legal determination. My witness isn't capable of making legal determinations. I'm going to ask them questions The first question is going to be very, very vague. The prosecutor is going to allow them to answer it. That's what I want. The second question is going to be more specific. It's going to be a question that they cannot answer because it requires a legal determination that they're not capable of even giving. Yep. In order to avoid their witness having to answer the question, the judge has to make a ruling that that witness cannot render legal determinations like they all 100% of the time. This is what they do. Or at least it's been my experience. I don't want to make a complete blanket statement, but 100% of the time that I've been in court, this is what they do. They object. They say it calls for a legal determination or that the witness isn't qualified to make legal determinations. The judge will sustain it or the judge will initiate it and do it themselves. And then I ask for the ticket to be dismissed or all of the legal determinations that were on the ticket to be stricken from the record. And realistically, they've put themselves in a catch-22. They've bound themselves to where now they have no other. The only thing that they can do from that point is say, rules be damned, I'm going to go ahead and find you guilty anyways. In Chris's case, though, and this is kind of a microcosm of what I see happening in the general public at large. In Chris's case, the judge dismissed his case. She told him to go ahead and sit down. She really screwed up by putting him at the front of the docket because usually when I go into court, they'll clear the docket. Nobody else will be on the docket. Or if there is people on the docket, they'll keep me there for 6 hours and make me go absolutely last. Chris, she wanted to make an example out of him. She thought she went in there very confident, thinking she was going to just, you know, kick his face into the dirt and rub his face in the sand. He got her and she had to withdraw or she had to dismiss the case.
Yeah.
As soon as he sits down, the next defendant comes up. The next kid was he was a black gentleman. He's wearing his pants. One of his legs is rolled up. He didn't even dress up for court. He's got his chain on. He's got his rag wrapped around his head. He walks up. It's the same cop that's the witness that cited him as well. They go through the whole thing. This kid has never been introduced to me, never read any of the stuff that I talk about, never heard any of the stuff I talk about, didn't know Chris. He just saw what Chris did. When he gets his chance to cross-examine, he looks at the cop and he says, "Officer, did you file a valid cause of action against me?" And the judge stops it right there. She says, "Officer, do you have your notes for this witness or for this citation?" And the cop says, "No, I don't have my notes for this stop either, Your Honor." She stops the court right in the middle. She goes, "Sir, your case is dismissed." Oh. She looks at the docket. She says, "Is anybody else here that this cop was the one that cited you?" And like six other people put their hands up. Oh, and she goes, "Go ahead and go talk to the bailiff. All of your cases are dismissed."
Wow. Really? Wow. That's pretty interesting.
So, I mean, When you go through that kind of a situation, when you see how illegitimate and arbitrary their rule over us is, when you see it firsthand, that's like probably a life-altering experience that is on par with nothing else. And that's the reason why I do this. That's the reason why when people come to me and ask me how I would handle their situation. That's the reason why I've dedicated so many years to learning this stuff. That's the reason why I am willing to teach and share these stories is because one by one, as people stand up and fight against it, one by one, these people are realizing that this God that they've bowed to and sacrificed half of their earnings to their entire life doesn't even exist. And the authority that it claims over them doesn't even exist. And that, to me, is something that even if it puts me in the crosshairs of these people, for me, it's something that is worth whatever the price is that has to be paid.
Wow. Well, well done. And I mean, as you said before, Nathan, you don't get involved where you have someone who's been, you know, hurt in that case. I mean, because people have to question as well, what is the point for this, for the money, for the ticket that are written for these things? And furthermore, where does all this money go, all the fines out there? And it just, you know, I mean, we have stories and cases. I remember a couple of years ago now coming out of Canada. I know this happened in the US as well, where basically the cops have been told to write more tickets because the state and the government, the local government, what have you, needs more revenue. They need more money. And that's why they're doing it.
Yeah. And not just that. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the Kids for Cash. scam, but three different judges, maybe even four now, have actually lost their position because these privatized kids prisons, these little prisons that are for juvenile delinquents, they've been offering judges kickbacks for the amount of people. They've been given bonuses for the amount of people that they can put in. And so there's been kids who got caught jaywalking and end up spending 7 years in these kids for cash privatized. I don't want to say privatized because they're really publicly funded, but these little private prisons that they have. And so, yeah, from top to bottom, it's all about, and when those kids go in, they get stuck doing slave labor. They get stuck making shoes for New Balance at 30 cents a day. Yep. And so there's a huge slave labor aspect to it. Then there's also the fact that all of this money that you pay in for court fines ends up going into these people's pension funds. And then you look at the CAFRs that these people have involvement with, and how these courts have all these investments in all these different corporations. And you start to realize that our entire legal system is just based off of how much money can this parasitical, like you mentioned, these parasites, how much money can they leech off of us? And taxation is not enough. They want as much as they can get from us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The prison economy. And I think America has one of the largest, prison populations, if you measure it per capita. And I mean, and it's on the rise and the increase as well. And they've turned this into, you know, a money machine, and to be able to compete, you know, in some cases with countries like China when it comes to production, in a similar scenario where they have a slave population over there. So, yeah, wow, it's unbelievable what's going on.
Yeah, but fortunately, and I'm sure that you probably have seen this in your listenership, fortunately, every single day, more and more people are waking up to these issues and standing up and, drawing their line in the sand. And whereas 5-6 years ago, when I first got into this whole legal battle system, it was just me, and every once in a while somebody would come to me and say, okay, I'm willing to try it. And now I get emails from people, three or four times a week saying, how can I do what you've done, or how can I be educated on the stuff that you're educated on? And it's a complete shift in it's like the tide is turning. More and more people every day are starting to wake up to this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. It is very encouraging, and anyone who starts to question and go deeper in terms of the reality that we're subjected to and spoon fed from young age, that's so positive. And it doesn't matter, in that regard, initially where people decide to go into it, or where they decide to begin question, but just that process starts, and that initial spark is kind of is there, because then people are off. I think something magical happens, if you will, when people go into that and just kind of awaken to a greater reality. And so that's why stuff that you're doing, and so many other people as well, is so encouraging, because it helps tremendously in that process, Nathan. So well done on that.
Absolutely. And I would just like to emphasize or drive home the fact that, yeah, we're living in scary times, but because of the ability to communicate, and because of the way that people, it seems like even younger and younger kids are starting to get this stuff. It seems like, whereas it used to be when I first started studying the legal system and studying the problems in politics, it was all people that were over 50 years old that were talking about this type of stuff. And now I have kids that are 14 and 15 years old hitting me up and sending me messages and saying, hey, I found your book, or I found your radio show, and I'm really turned on by this stuff. And it seems like young, not only is it more and more people, but the people that it's reaching are younger and younger, and the next generation is going to have a huge impact. And I, as scary as things are, as depressing as it is when you look at what's going on with the priest class, the current priest class that we have, and when you look at what typically has happened when they start to lose their power, how they react, it is scary. But I honestly do believe that we're living in a very exciting time right now, and I think that we're living in a pivotal point in history where in the future, if we're able to, and I think that there's a good chance that we will be able to spread the ideas of freedom and let people know about, you know, what autonomy, what personal sovereignty really are, what liberty really is, I think that we're living in a pivotal time right now where we actually can tilt the scale into a free society. And I think that that's it. For nothing else, I'm grateful to be living in a time period where we're actually starting to see the possibility of freedom actually becoming a staple of society.
Yeah, yeah, very good. And in that process, as you say, they might become more more desperate. I'm talking about the people who are, you know, trying to keep this situation as they see it under control, but really it's chaos. But as they see it, I think that they become more and more desperate, and consequently they might become more violent as they become to realize that they're kind of losing this battle, that they're losing the control. But ultimately all of that is actually a good sign, Nathan. I mean, the harder they're trying to squeeze and you know, crush, if you will, the human spirit, the more that signal should, you know, the signal that should be sent to people is that, all right, okay, they've you know, ramped up the battle for a reason. They're getting more and more scared, and ultimately that's a really, really good thing. So people should not, you know, just kind of bow down and quiet down to that. They should realize, you know, keep doing what you're doing, because it's heading in the right direction.
Yeah, it should be viewed as their reaction is it's proof that we're actually having an effect.
Yeah, you're right. Very good, Nathan. Yeah, excellent stuff. I really have been enjoying this. Is there anything before we round things up at this time that we've left out, or something else you feel that's pertinent to mention? Or, I mean, you've clarified a little bit, of course, of why it's important to learn this stuff and why you want to, you know, pass it on to others, and also how it, you know, helps to tear down the myth of so-called legitimate government and the statist argument and everything else. But is something we've left out? What do you think?
I think that the overall message that I try to convey to people that is missed by a lot of the other people out there that are promoting these type of ideals, I think the overall message that I would like to leave people with, that is, in my opinion, sadly ignored most of the time, is that this isn't about getting your one case dismissed. This isn't about having your one victory. This isn't about having the court declare that you should be sovereign. This is about building a society where all people are recognized as autonomous, where all people are recognized as free, where all people are recognized as equal, and nobody is recognized as a legitimate coercive authority. And so often, in, I think, from the gurus of this field down to the people that are studying it, it's about their own personal issue. And I want to get my case thrown out. I want to have the courts leave me alone. And I think that that's really missing the point. I think that the greater point should be, how do we build a society where people are free and this isn't even an issue that anybody has to deal with? So instead of focusing on how do I become a sovereign citizen, or how do I get the courts to leave me alone, I think that what we really need to be focusing on, and what happens every time a person gets the case dismissed, is how do we wake people up to the fact that coercive authoritarian tyranny, whether it's soft tyranny or hardcore tyranny, that all of it is legitimate and it has no place in society. And that I think that the most important thing is we don't work for our own personal freedom, that we understand in order to be free, we have to have an entire society of free individuals. And until we stop excusing a system that allows us to control other people, and we realize that if we don't want to be controlled, we need to stop trying to control and excusing the control of other people, that we're going to continue down the path of slavery. So more so than just trying to be free yourself, the main goal for myself and what I think that most people should really think about and work towards is making sure that we live in a free society, not that we're just one single free individual.
Very well said. Everyone should be free. And of course, this should be at the pinnacle of what people strive for overall. And I'm just very surprised and shocked when people, you know, don't even have that, you know, perception. But again, it's about awakening that spirit for people to realize that what's so important with it. But there's so many, because that's why it's so well said what you just talked about here. There's so many who are still willing, it seems, to kind of just look the other way, just as long as it's not them who are being targeted or their little cult or group or affiliation, what have you. It's like, you know, it's like the saying, either we believe in freedom for everyone or for none at all. There is no, you know, there's no in-between, Sarah. We can't even be, you know, a little bit free and then have a little bit of or quite some tyranny. It's like, that is a black and white issue. Either we are free and that means it's freedom for everyone, or none of us have it, and then, you know, it's nothing we do have. So therefore, that's why that battle is so important. And just, I just hope and encourage that more and more people realize that as well, and not let their politics get in the way, their, as I said, their affiliations or their groupings or what have you, where so many people are willing to fight and instead say, you know, they're fine with, you know, as long as you imprison the other guy and point fingers and everything else, but that there should be in that strive, there should be a common ground, which should be the most important of all. It's like, let's settle this issue first of removing tyrannical states and governments and everything else so that we can enable ourselves and have our own experience and choose our lives as we want to live them. And then we can debate about the smaller details of that. You know, it's incredible. Yeah,
and I think that one of the things that we've been talking about, the legitimacy that these people have, or the veil of legitimacy, one thing that makes it really hard to give that up is our individual lust to control other people. I don't want somebody owning this type of magazine for their rifle, or I don't want somebody being able to own this type of plant, or I don't want somebody being able to do a number of different things that have no effect on me whatsoever, have no potential to harm me whatsoever. As long as we are begging for a system that allows us to control the people around us, then we're begging for a system that allows the people around us to control us. Yeah. And if we want to be free, and at the same time, we're advocating for a system to remain in place that gives us control over the people around us, we're fighting contradictory battles, and we're never going to win. So it comes down to, you can't just want yourself to be free. You can't just want to win your particular case so that you can be free. If you're going to accomplish this, and the only thing that's really worth fighting for is to make sure that everyone around you is free as well.
Yeah, very well said. And it's one more point I want to mention about this here. It's to, you know, have the ability and have the strength then in that regard, as some people seem that that's a difficult thing, but to let people live how they want to live. And that one of the things that are creeping into our world right now, Nathan, as I see it as well, is a nuance to this, is that, you know, we talked about it before, as long as you don't hurt anybody or damage, you know, anyone in that sense, then it's okay, then it's fine. But what we've seen in the world is that we have a very, very, with political correctness and this attitude that you cannot be allowed to offend anyone, for example, that's now considered to be damage, if you will, to either to the person or to property or anything like that, hate speech and all these other kinds of things, where we're treading into a very, 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 very difficult area, which is, you know, intensely dangerous as well, because it has to do with freedom of speech and this idea that as long as you just says anything that hurts someone emotionally, then, you know, you're a criminal. It's very dangerous. What do you think about this, Nathan?
I would agree. It's very dangerous. It's kind of a muddy waters, really gray area, even in my own philosophy. But realistically, it comes down to, like I stated at the very beginning, are you coercing somebody? Are you aggressing against somebody? If not, then your actions should not be limited. So by saying something that you don't want to hear, I'm still not coercing you, and I'm still not aggressing against you, and I still haven't actually caused you any harm. So by saying I have the right not to hear certain things, what you're really doing is you're becoming the aggressor. You're saying I have the right to control, coerce what you're allowed to say. So in that case, you can play the victim. But if you look at it from the only real law, in my opinion, is non-aggression. You're the aggressor if you're trying to stop somebody from being able to exercise their free speech. So in my opinion, even though society seems to have it backwards, in my opinion, the person that is claiming the injury in that is actually the aggressor.
Very well said, Nathan. Thank you so much for your time today. Please keep up the good work. We'd love to have you back again at some point, of course. But give us the website again so people know where to go to check out your work.
Yeah, it's livefreefm.com. That's livefreefm.com. And if you want to tune into the show, it's on every single Sunday night on the Truth Frequency Radio Network. And I just wanted to say a huge thank you. I know that I told you before we went on the air, being on Red Ice Creations has been like a dream come true for me. So thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much, Nathan. We really appreciate that. Have a good evening. Thank you.
You as well.
And a couple of things for you guys before we end for this time. Don't miss the next Radio 314 program. We have Lucian Valsan with us from Romania. This will be a follow-up to the two previous ones we did on feminism. I'll guest host that one with Lana as well. To tune in, check radio314.com or click the link from the redicemembers.com front page. The next Red Ice program is with Froderick on the secret war within Freemasonry. That shall be interesting, I think. Thank you for listening, and as always, a big, special, warm thanks to all our amazing members, old and new, who not only makes the program possible, but allows us to expand and work on more material that we can present to you. Stay well, stay safe, and we'll be back in just a few.